Several months ago, I had the pleasure of speaking with today's guest and her colleague about the research about the challenges of pet loss and bereavement. There was so much information shared during that discussion, so I asked Angie Arora to return to take a deeper dive into the topics of pet loss and bereavement, the stages of grief, how to memorialize a beloved pet, and some of the challenges faced during the pandemic. Angie is a registered social worker from Toronto, Canada, with over 16 years of experience in the field of pet loss and veterinary compassion resilience. She is a virtual pet loss facilitator and lead coach for VetVine's Wellness and Professional Resiliency Coaching Program. She also continues to do research to better support clients through pets' end of life. I'm looking forward to hearing more about the work Angie is doing to help people through various stages of the grief process.
Welcome to the Animal Academy podcast. I'm Allison White, and I'm a licensed clinical social worker who specializes in the human-animal connection. This podcast will showcase professionals who share their areas of expertise in an ongoing series of interviews, and you are there. Their input, stories, and knowledge will help us all understand that we are the ones that actually end up learning from the animals. This is the Animal Academy Podcast.
Angie, thank you so much for agreeing to meet with me again.
Lovely to be here.
I can't remember when we last talked. Was that last fall?
I want to say it was the fall. Like, part of me thinks it was earlier this year, but I really do think it was 2020.
The whole year, you know, has been kind of like, I've lost track of time. So anyway, I enjoyed speaking with you before on a former podcast. And I thought, let me bring you back because we could have talked for hours. And I thought, let's do a deeper dive into, you know, one of your areas of expertise. And so I'm glad you could join me today.
Wonderful.
So Angie, could you tell me a little bit about what led you to become interested in doing this type of work?
Yeah, absolutely. This is actually one of my favorite things to talk about. And it really helps ground me even when I kind of go back into my own personal history. So a lot of what led me into the work of doing pet loss support starts all the way back in 2004. And it was the year, there were two really big things happening in my life at that time. My dog Monty of nearly 18 years was diagnosed with bone cancer. And at the same time, I was also completing my master's of social work. And I remember having to take a little bit of time off my schooling because I really wanted to spend those final weeks and days with him, helping to nurse him at home. He ended up passing away in my arms. It was, at the time, a very traumatic loss. But one of the things that I was able to do pretty quickly was recognize the need for my own personal support. And then we're talking all the way back in 2004, right? And the conversations around pet loss were just not happening the way that they are now. So I was really fortunate to be able to start attending a pet loss support group that was being offered in my neighborhood at the time. And within about 6 months, I was going pretty regularly. Within about 6 months, by that point, I had completed my master's of social work and I was starting to co-facilitate the group myself because I just found that there was this natural kind of segue. It's really powerful what grief can do in terms of how we can transform it. And so that led me on my journey. And so since literally 2004, I have been facilitating pet loss support groups on and off, primarily within community-based settings with different organizations, as well as in 2008, I was working as a hospital social worker. And I say this often, back in 2008, I had no idea that there was a name for what I was doing. Now, what we commonly refer to as veterinary social work. I remember doing it without the infrastructure that was really needed to do it well. But with that being said, you know, had the opportunity to deepen my counseling and pet loss support work during that time and haven't really stopped. For me, it's the pet loss support that really keeps me grounded in the human-animal bond. And I currently have two senior ones with me, and I personally myself feel like I'm already at the anticipatory grief stage with one of them. But I definitely feel way more equipped to kind of process what I know is about to come now than I did in 2004.
Well, and isn't it interesting how we grab onto the things that impact our lives the most, and we can choose, you know, to make a difference by actually going into that in greater depth, which I've found myself with the work that I'm doing as well, is that something touches you and realizes that, oh, I can use this to really help other people because I've been through it myself.
That's it. The lived experience really drives, I think, empathy to a totally different level.
So you'd mentioned anticipatory grief, and grief is such a broad term. Would you mind kind of walking us through the different types of grief?
Yeah, absolutely. And so I'll start with this one around anticipatory, because I think in the world of pet loss, it's probably the one that is most commonly understood and the one that those of us working within the sector refer to a lot. But really, anticipatory grief is grief that begins before the physical loss of death. And that can mean so many different things to different people. You know, I'll use myself as an example. Right now, my dog Enzo, while he has not been diagnosed with a terminal illness of any sort, it's the aging process that begins the anticipatory grief. And so I see things like, you know, the loss of his hearing, the loss of being able to fully engage in regular activities, the slowing loss of his eyesight. All of that can be part of the anticipatory grieving process because you're starting to see losses, even though they're on a small level. It starts to remind you of what is imminently going to happen. It's not like when they were young puppies and you know that you've got another, if you're lucky, another 10, 12 years with them. I know that within the next couple of years, I'm looking at facing the loss. And so it's that constant reminder that the end will be coming. But more commonly, I think when we're talking about anticipatory grief in the context of pet loss, it tends to kick in at the time of a terminal diagnosis or a diagnosis that we know will eventually lead to poorer quality of life and subsequently death. And age is not relevant here because you could have a 2-year-old cat or kitten and receive a terminal diagnosis. And so at a very young age of their lives, you may be already in this place of anticipatory grief.
And you know what's so hard about that time, Angie, is that when you're hit with a shocker like that of a sudden diagnosis, especially when you have a young pet, is having to make some really, really hard decisions mm-hmm. when you're in crisis mode.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think it shocks your coping mechanisms because it's something that you weren't prepared for. It's something that you weren't ready for. And quite frankly, you know, I think about so many of the people that I've been able to support, even when we know they're getting old, we're still not ready for it. It's like, we're just not ready for it because the bond is just so strong and so special. And, you know, one of the things that's been on my mind a lot more, particularly based on some recent research that I've been involved with, is the differing experiences based on species. And so while we so often think about this in terms of dogs and cats, you know, we think about more smaller animals like rabbits or hamsters and rats that generally have a much shorter life expectancy. You can go from that really forming the bond to having this intense bond and then moving into this anticipatory phase really quickly, right? We may not be looking at 10 to 12 years. We might be looking at within 1 to 2 years of having them. Goldfish, right? Fish as well. And so there's so many layers to this that giving it a name is helpful because it allows us to better understand the overwhelming nature of what we're feeling and experiencing.
Exactly. And there's some other types of grief. Would you like to go into those?
Another one that's really been on my mind is this idea of cumulative or compounded grief. And I think it's one that we don't talk about, in my opinion, enough. Given the context of COVID, I don't think we can ignore this. If I had to say what's one of the biggest things that has stood out to me over the last year of providing pet loss support, it's this. And in really simple language, sometimes it's referred to as grief overload. It's kind of like when you have multiple losses compounding the other. And those losses don't always have to be the losses of an animal or a pet. It could be, you know, think of COVID right now. The entire world is grieving losses on so many levels. And so one of the things that I'm seeing in pet loss support groups that I'm running is this compounded grief, where I already felt, or not even felt, I have already experienced really significant losses. I've lost my job. I've lost the ability to see family members. I've lost my social support network. I've lost a partner. I've lost someone to COVID. My pet was my constant. And now that they're gone, it's not just the loss of that pet that I'm grieving, but it's the compounded nature of losses that can kind of lead us sometimes to more complicated grief. And I've been seeing this a little bit more where, you know, complicated grief has more to do with when something is happening to stop like the natural healing process. And I use that language loosely because I don't prescribe to, you know, there's one way of grieving. But oftentimes when there's trauma involved or multiple losses or even unresolved grief from months and years ago, we can sometimes get ourselves in this position of being stuck in our grief. You know, some people will refer to this as more maladaptive coping mechanisms, where if we're looking at it from a pattern behavior, perhaps I'm doing things that are more on the numbing side, as opposed to really kind of embracing and learning to work through the grief. And these are the ones that can become a little bit more tricky, I find, and complicated to kind of support through the pet loss group setting. And we'll often make referrals to outside counselors and therapists when we get into this place of more complicated grief.
Besides taxing all of our coping skills, what I've heard from people too is the lack of a support system because other people are also grieving in the same way. And if you have COVID or have had it, you may not return to the same level of functioning as quickly as you would have hoped to be if it was the flu or something.
And that piece on the social support network is everything when it comes to grief and the, you know, external expression of mourning. We're not meant to go through these things alone. And so it becomes all the more important to find ways to tap into support networks, I would say now more than ever. And the good news is we are seeing that some organizations are looking at how to kind of take their work and support and put it in an online space so that folks are not being left isolated and left to fend for this on their own. Just generally speaking, you know, we're not taught on how to grieve. It's not considered a life skill, even though it is and it needs to be. And so this is what I often find when I'm supporting people is they can become so overwhelmed with what they're feeling and experiencing that they don't even have the sort of the tools in their toolkit for how do I begin to process this in a healthy, meaningful way.
I was just talking to somebody about that yesterday, and the people I have seen in my private practice and therapy for a period of time didn't have as much trouble as we moved into COVID and some of the anxiety and stressors that other people have had. But the people who have not had therapy in the past, have not, you know, taken classes or, you know, basic stress reduction, really had a difficult time when they were forced to stay home. And then all of a sudden they're having to deal with things and they didn't have the coping skills.
Yeah. And I think so much of it begins with the self-awareness. And I'm talking really, really basic here, but if you don't have this, everything else becomes so much more difficult. And what I mean by self-awareness is when I'm starting to feel something, can I label the emotion, right? Like, can I even say what it is that I'm feeling? That is a skill that we, in my opinion, do such an injustice on when it comes to raising our children and learning to function as adults. You know, I have a three-year-old son at home, and it is becoming the basis of pretty much most of our conversations these days, because as we know, it takes a long time to learn to regulate your emotions. And it makes me feel good to know that I can provide him the space to feel whatever it is that he needs to feel, but still do it in this safe space and helping him, even at the age of three, to name his emotions. You know, I've worked with 40-year-olds and 50-year-olds who can't do that. It's not their fault. It's just something that we need support in learning how to do. And I find, you know, kind of similar to what you were saying, that in the people that I support who have that really enhanced level of self-awareness, they're able to maneuver through the grieving process. I'm not going to say easier because grief is tough, but they don't necessarily feel as powerless. because there is some power that you gain from being able to name and label your emotion. And one of the things that I'll do with folks in group, because I think that the labeling of emotions is one part, but there's still so many other things that we need to do to foster self-awareness is, you know, can I connect my thoughts to my emotions? So when I'm thinking something, what emotions does it trigger? Or vice versa. And the third area, because it's become just so powerful in my own life, is where in my body am I feeling it? You know, the connection to the physical, I think it becomes so important in everyday life, but especially during grief, when we know that it can manifest physically in terms of fatigue and headaches and that tightness in our chest. And when we can start to learn how to work through, you know, that self-awareness process, we're just so much more in tune with what we need. And when we know what we need, then we can be our own best advocates to make sure that we get it.
That's really important and well said, Angie, because the whole mind body, it's so important to realize that one impacts the other. So just having good sleep, making sure you're eating the right foods, and then we're missing a lot of the social connections. So that piece has really been at a deficit. But then the other part that I've noticed myself is I'm sitting in one spot the entire day. I may do 45 steps around my house during the day, which is greatly reduced from me going out in the community and going to work. Now, I don't miss traffic as much, but I still miss the movement. And so I feel a sense of stuckness in my body quite a bit of the time.
You know, it's so interesting you mentioned that because I can't help but also think about the importance of routine that our pets bring to our lives. And, you know, when they're here with us, by like literally every day at 12 p.m., Enzo is by my feet and he is scratching me to make sure that I get up and we go outside. And I literally schedule my meetings around his need for the walk. But it's not just him that needs the walk. It's me too. Right. But then when folks are experiencing the loss of their pets, whether that's at a point where they're still alive, but they're in their final days and weeks, or if it's the actual loss, routine gets totally disrupted. And, you know, again, one of the things that we'll talk about in group is it can feel very overwhelming to have a loss of your routine, but how do we start to build up a new routine? Because that self-love and that self-care and that self-compassion is exactly what people need during grief. But we live in, especially in a North American context, we live in this culture of let's beat ourselves up. Let's drown ourselves in guilt. Let's think the thoughts that make me feel bad about myself. Mm-hmm. And it's totally counterintuitive to what our bodies actually need. And so this idea of, I think, of self-compassion is really, really important. And I try to talk about this during our groups because it's more often than not what people are not doing during their grieving process, yet it's what they need the most.
Well, self-compassion, I love to talk about too. And Dr. Krista Neff has a great book that I direct clients to read. Several of them have said, why? Because I made a really bad decision. And they use the term bad to say goodbye to their pet. They still have a lot of shame and guilt related to end-of-life decisions.
Huge. I'm so glad that you brought up her book because that's been the driving force for me as well. Mm-hmm. Behind understanding self-compassion at a much deeper level. I think sometimes when people hear self-compassion, you know, they just think of love yourself. And while that's important, you know, I think she does such a great job in kind of breaking down the three layers of self-compassion, like around self-kindness and how do we learn to really be gentle with ourselves? It's again, something that we're not taught to do. And in, you know, capitalist society where productivity is everything, learning to kind of stop, pause, and recognize what I need and putting that first is again, something that a lot of folks really don't do. And I like to think of self-compassion as like the anti-guilt because they're two totally very different ways of treating yourself. It's not like we take guilt and throw it out the door and never think about it or never feel it. There is some self-protective stuff that's going on for us, I think, when we're experiencing guilt. And quite frankly, it's a human emotion and we can't help but feel it. I think the problem becomes when we start to get stuck in it and we start to beat ourselves up in this patterned way, we're not doing ourselves any favors. And so another element, I think, of how she talks about self-compassion is common humanity, which is so, so important, that recognizing that suffering is part of the human condition, we cannot escape it. But how do we start to recognize that I'm not going through this alone, that what I'm feeling has been felt by others? And sometimes that can just alleviate even a little bit of the pressure. You know, I remember in my social work training, one of my professors referred to this as social empathy. And it's something that has stuck with me, that can I situate my experiences in this broader macro lens of things that others have also experienced, helps me to feel just a little bit less alone and isolated. And then finally, the third component of self-compassion she talks about is mindfulness, and kind of like, you know, holding our thoughts and our emotions with this lens of openness. It doesn't mean that we avoid our feelings, and it doesn't mean that we ignore them, but how do we strike this balance so that we're not all consumed by them? And so, you know, for me, one of the things that stood out as I read her book was, if the feelings feel too much, pull back from them. Put up an invisible wall if you have to. That doesn't mean that you're avoiding. That's self-compassion. That in the moment, this is just too much for me. And it's okay to give myself permission to take a break from the intensity of guilt or the intensity of sadness. And I love that idea of finding the balance. You know, for some people, it can be hard to find it. And I think some of the questions that can help guide us in fostering self-compassion is, how would you treat a close family member or a friend if they were going through something? What would you say to them? Is that what you're saying to yourself? You know, do you have the ability to self-soothe? And self-soothe can mean so many different things. But, you know, she talks about the importance of self-touch, and being able to comfort myself is self-compassion. And so again, you know, to your point, I think if folks are interested in learning about this some more, her book is just phenomenal in really shifting the way that we think about self-compassion.
I refer people to that all the time. And people will often say, but isn't that being selfish to set up my own boundaries? And isn't self-compassion being selfish? And so then we have to explain the difference between that, is we have to take care of ourselves first. Really?
Absolutely. And it's, don't you think it's like a bit of this culture shift that we just, gives me hope and promise is that I think we're on the brink of that. Like, I think the narrative is starting to shift, and industries that perhaps would have never invited these kinds of conversations, like veterinary medicine, are now starting to do so, because we know from research, it's not just our opinion. We know from research that this holds value on so many different levels.
One of the other things that I hear very frequently from people is, my support system isn't necessarily my support system when I've lost my pet, because they just can't relate at the same level. And so I do encourage them to find a support system that does value the human-animal connection, so they get the help they need.
Yeah, that's so huge, right? Because we know that pet loss is considered a form of disenfranchised grief all these years later, that we've been trying to shift the dialogue and the narrative, but it's still there. And when it's not societally recognized as, you know, a quote unquote valid form of grief, we lose those support networks that, to your point, are so evident in other aspects of our life. And I've had this happen to myself too, right? That the people who I could turn to for every other part of my life were not there. They weren't there when I've experienced the loss of a pet. And it can, if you're not careful, it can even start to harbor, you can start to harbor these feelings of resentment, right? How can you not be? And it's because you don't recognize how profound of a loss this has been for me. And so this is where I think that, while the ultimate goal is to change the way that people can support others during pet loss, at bare minimum, if somebody can even get into a group or a counseling session, that I find can make a really big difference. I don't tend to see people coming to multiple groups because they don't always need it. You know, they may come to one, two, or three and feel that they get the validation to the point where now they can kind of go off and continue the work that they need to do. But, you know, it just brings me to this point of, when we're not validated, it can really complicate the rest of our healing journey. It's a fundamental need that is, quite frankly, not adequately addressed when it comes to losing a pet.
And normalizing the experience of the loss that pets bring into our lives. And So I may see people just for one or two sessions and then they move on to into their lives, or they could go to a pet loss group. I've made several referrals for those too. But just when they come in, they have such guilt and shame over feeling very strong emotions. And once we validate and normalize those, they're like, oh, okay. Yeah. This is what other people go through.
That's it. Exactly.
So the time of COVID has been a real challenge too. And I've heard from folks who have not even been able to be with their pet at the time of euthanasia, which we've never had to deal with anything like this before. And it's very unsettling.
It really is, because it's taking away, again, some of our most fundamental needs during those final days. It has totally transformed the grieving process. And, it, you know, to your point, the way that end of life has been addressed, you know, I think that to their credit, there's been a lot of practices in hospitals that have really done their best and trying to come up with creative, inclusive ways for people to be with their pets in their final moments, even if they can't be there with them physically. You know, we've heard of some that are able to do the euthanasias outside with distancing, or euthanasias in the car so that the person can still be there. But in situations where the person can't be there in person, we've heard of practices that will use tools like FaceTime so that the person can still at least see what's happening if that's something that they choose to. I think one of the ones that has hit me the strongest was hearing about somebody who wrote a letter to their pet. And although they couldn't be there, they had the veterinarian, or it might have been somebody else who was in the room, read the letter right before the euthanasia. And that one, I have to be honest with you, it still brings tears to my eyes when I think about it.
That's powerful.
It's so powerful. And I think that's what this is teaching us, is how do we learn to adapt, but not sacrificing our needs in the process? And it, like so many industries, right, it has forced us to think outside the box in so many different ways. And that one, you know, that one example to me is so poignant. But, you know, coming back to this idea of social support networks, because I think this is so huge, we hear this often from people that they're not able to tap into their networks the same way they could before. And you know, I'll have people tell me, well, it's not the same to do it over Zoom or to call them. Like, I just need their touch. I need their hug. And that's been hard. That's been really, really hard. And so we'll talk about, well, what can we focus on that's within our control? And I think that that's what COVID has left so many people feeling powerless and helpless in so many ways. And that has just become really exacerbated when it comes to pet loss. And so we'll talk about that, you know, the idea of memorialization, which is so important when we've experienced any type of loss, even more so important now in the context of COVID. And so you may not be able to do a full-fledged memorial service, but what can you still do? Can you do something with your immediate family members? I've had one person that I was working with who did a Zoom memorial, and each person who was present had a strong connection with their animal, and they each had shared pictures in advance, and they did a bit of a slideshow, and there was the reading of poems. And so what gives
That's awesome.
Isn't it though, right? Like, because we still find ways to do what our bodies need, even though it's still challenging and difficult. And so I think that, you know, a lot of what COVID has led us to is learning to focus on what is within our control so that our needs can still be met. And people are quite resilient in that way, in finding what they need and making sure that they get it.
When you're talking about memorializing, I'm looking back at some of the ways that I memorialized my past pets, and each was a little bit different. And it's kind of interesting to think about it, because I had different relationships with each one of them. I found myself, I'm not a scrapbook person, but I found myself creating these scrapbooks and going to Michael's and getting all kinds of cute animal things to put in scrapbooks. And then I did little index cards with different memories that went with the different pictures. And I actually printed out each one of the pictures. So each part of that was like a ritual that helped me move through some of those memories and the loss.
So beautiful. It's interesting that you talked about you're not a scrapbooking person, but yet that experience still led you towards doing it, because it's what you needed. Yeah, I totally get that. And I'm sure you see this in your work as well. But, you know, when we're talking about memorialization, it doesn't have to be these big, elaborate things. While some folks will, I know of people that have done full-fledged funerals for their pets. And I think that's important. If that's important to you, then it's important. You know, memorial services are definitely on the rise, but it can be something as simple. And this example stands out to me. It was somebody who attended a group several months ago, and he talked about just placing a wind chime in the spot that he used to hang out with his dog on the back porch.
Oh.
Just something as simple as that.
Wow.
And that wind chime, every time, you know, like he positioned it in a way, every time it rang, he would just kind of sit there in the morning with his morning coffee and reflect and feel like his dog was with him in a different way. And so I think this idea of memorializing, first off, we need it. It's part of the grieving process. It's good for us. It's a way to channel the intensity of emotions. And it also connects to, partly sometimes, it can connect to finding meaning, I think, as well. And just reminding ourselves that it doesn't have to be this big elaborate thing. So, you know, you talked about scrapbooking, the wind chimes. You know, I remember when Monty, my dog who I started talking about at the very beginning, I had a star named after him. And that was like, right, like that. And I still have it. I still have the certificate here. And I remember in those early, early days, I would just look up at the sky and know that his light was still shining down on me. And it, again, it was symbolism. And I think that that's what these different types of rituals do, is they take the intensity of the emotions associated with grief. They allow us to process them and add meaning to them.
And you also are able to realize that the pet that had been with you for a number of years is still part of you.
That's it. That reminds me, I think, of something that has been sitting with me for weeks, if not months now. And many of us know about the five stages of grief. I mean, really, to be authentic and fair, it started out as the five stages of dying by Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. And I think where that's been getting a bit more attention as of late is some of the work that David Kessler's been doing. And he's considered to be her protege, right? Like, I mean, he worked with her for many years, wrote books with her. I don't think there's anybody else who would kind of know her material as intimately as him. And him and Elizabeth Kubler-Ross talked a lot about how the way that they had framed the five stages of dying, which were then transformed into the stages of grief, have been totally like botched by mainstream. Like the meaning that they had put behind them is not what you now see. They've never suggested that they're linear processes. We all know, those of us that do grief work, that grief operates in waves. They acknowledge that. The reason I bring this up is that more recently, he was given permission to add a sixth stage to the five stages of grief, and that is meaning. I think back to 2004, after Monty died, in addition to attending a pet loss support group, I was really fortunate to find a therapist who specialized in pet loss. And I don't remember a lot of our sessions, but there's one thing all these years later that still stands out to me. And she asked me this one question, and she said, "What has Monty taught you?" And that one question has transformed my life. It has literally transformed my life, because he has taught me so many things around the need to honor and pay attention to and honor and create space for what we're feeling. And I think through that journey, all the work that I've been doing for the last 16 years comes from what he's taught me. And so to hear David Kessler talk about the sixth stage, I think really hits home. And he talks about how traditionally we talk about the fifth stage of grief as being acceptance, that we come to terms with the fact that this loss has happened and that my life is now different. And he has been saying for so long that that's just not enough. People need more. People need to know the meaning. And so what he means by the meaning, and if anyone has a chance to read his book that has just recently come out, I would highly, highly encourage it. But it can be something like, what did that person or that animal or that pet teach you? But it's also about finding meaning in the relationship that you had with them. What purpose did it bring your life? What were you able to bring into theirs? That's the part that lives in you forever, right? Like, how can you start to make your life better because of the relationship that you had with them? And we're not going to be able to get there overnight. I think this is really a journey. And in his book, he provides a lot of like ways to walk through this process because we need help on how to do this as well. This is what gives me hope and comfort when I'm supporting people, that in the initial stages, it may be very difficult to wrap your head around this. But for people who dive into this, it can literally be life-altering.
Angie, that's really a powerful message. And we're going to make sure that we add his book to our show notes as well. And I was just reflecting back as you were talking about it, and I thought, everybody that I've lost in my past, as well as, you know, my pets, family members, friends, have brought my life meaning in a lot of different ways and have made me who I am now.
That's it. And I think we intuitively know it, but there's something really powerful about writing about it, talking about it, saying out loud, and drawing the connections. Because that's also what continues to give our life purpose, mm-hmm. which can be very difficult to remind ourselves of when we're deep in grief. That because oftentimes, and I'm sure you've heard this too, right? That you'll hear people talk about what purpose is there? Like, what purpose do I have in life when I don't have that pet or that person with me anymore? Mm-hmm. So this journey of finding that meaning reconnects us back to purpose and can make our lives even better, which is that hope that we need.
Yeah. And I've heard people say that they wanted to sell their house. They didn't want to vacuum ever again because it would mean vacuuming up their pet's hairs, or they didn't want to come home at the end of the day because it would mean coming into an empty house. So it's reframing that for them as they go through that grief process.
Yeah. And you know what? I find that it's this very kind of fine balance that you have to be able to strike, because the meaning is important, but we still have to be able to process the range of emotions that come with grief along the way. And so, mm-hmm. you know, I don't necessarily get into these conversations too early on in the relationship,
sure.
but I will, even the first time I meet somebody, I'll kind of leave them with that same question that was asked for me. Or asked of me, I should say. And, you know, what have they taught you? And you don't have to be able to answer that right now. Just jot it down on a piece of paper, put it aside. And when the time is right, start to delve into it.
Angie, you've been doing pet loss and bereavement groups for quite some time. Mm-hmm. What are some of the greatest lessons you think that you've learned from the people that you've helped?
That's powerful. I would probably say that one of the most powerful things, and I know this is going to sound really kind of cliche and basic, but it really has been a lesson for me, is that every emotion is meant to be felt. And within even the most toughest ones, on the same side of that, though, is as much as every emotion is meant to be felt, the intensity of pain is temporary. We're not going to be stuck in intense emotions forever. Can I learn to swim through the tough, painful moments, knowing that there is a way out? And so I think from that comes that even though we don't necessarily feel it, I've come to learn from the number of people that I've supported over 16 years, is that we all have the capacity to learn and grow from our losses. And I think that's what keeps me doing the work. Because, you know, sometimes I'll have, especially my students who I teach, will say, like, how do you do this work? It's so intense and it's so sad. And how do you keep doing it? I get that, because that's how I used to feel at the beginning, right? I would have to sometimes take breaks from doing this work because it would feel to be too much, until this idea of purpose and meaning started to enter into the equation. It kind of gives me hope. Every single person I talk to, even if I only get to talk to them once, I know that there's more for them ahead. There's more learning that's going to come. And I think the other piece that I've learned is, again, really basic, but we all need unconditional love. That's what we get from our pets, right? We hear this over and over again, right? What was different about this relationship is that it was unconditional. And while it's difficult to get that from humans, I think what I've also learned is that as humans, human-to-human relationships, we put up way too many blocks when we're connecting with people. Way too many blocks for a number of reasons. But when we're there in the moment with our pet, those blocks aren't there. And if there are any lessons that can be taken from the relationships we have with our pets and to transform them into our human relationships, how different the world would be.
But I was even thinking too, at this, you know, very challenging year for everybody in a variety of different ways, our pets didn't know about that. You know, they just knew we were home most of the time and could give them love and, you know, help our anxiety. Janine Mogo, when I spoke with her on my podcast the other day, said something that has stuck with me ever since. She said, you know, our pets take care of us. And they really do. I never really thought about it like that, although I knew it to be true.
I could not agree with that more. It's so true, right? We think, and I think that's where the grieving process becomes so difficult, because it's a loss on so many levels, right? It's not just the physical loss, obviously, but it's the loss of what that relationship represented, right? Were they that one place that I could go to shed my tears without anyone telling me to stop crying? Was it the one place that I could be my true, authentic self and get on the floor and be silly and make the noises I could never make with anyone else, right? Those types of, it's like an authentic relationship that meets our needs on so many levels. And, you know, it reminds me of, and I don't want to dive too deep into this because I'm no way an expert, but Meg Olmert wrote a book. I think this was quite a while back. It was called Made for Each Other. And in it, she does some really exploratory, groundbreaking research on oxytocin. The levels of oxytocin, kind of more commonly known as the cuddling hormone, the love hormone, gets released at similar levels between humans and animals that it does between mothers who are nursing their newborn babies. That's how we know about the scientific research behind the human-animal connection. But then the flip side of that is when we lose them, we go into this oxytocin crash. And so if we don't have this space or place to be able to feel nurtured, to be able to nurture others, it can be a really, really taxing, overwhelming process for someone to go through. Again, it kind of circles us back to this overarching theme around how do we better care for and support each other, because we're just not meant to go through this alone.
So the first step would be acknowledgement of, mm-hmm. and this using the self-compassion, and then also being able to reach out and get the help we need.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think with the piece with pet loss, what's been so difficult for so many years is even if there is an acknowledgement that I need help, help has not always been readily available. The good news mm-hmm. is that's now starting to shift.
Thank goodness.
Right? Like, I think one of the good things that's happened as a result of COVID is the movement of services to be offered online as yes. a way of reducing, you know, accessibility barriers. And so now we know that no matter where you are, you can access a pet loss support group. Whereas mm-hmm. before you were contingent on whether it was offered in your local neighborhood or not. And I think that's huge.
That is very, very huge. And so, Angie, you run a variety of different pet loss groups. How can people access those?
So the one that I'm involved with right now is through an organization called Vetvine. And if folks want to learn more about it, you know, just go onto their website, vetvine.com, and there is a tab for pet loss support. And more specifically, the service offering is called Virtual Pet Loss Support Services. And we offer a variety of supports. And so if somebody just wants to chat one-to-one, that option's available as well as group. Sometimes people just want that one-to-one intimate nature. Others want to be around others. And there is one-to-one and group sessions available both for anticipatory loss as well as physical pet loss. And so, you know, we don't say that you can only come and talk to us once you've lost your pet. We're actually starting to see a greater uptake of people coming to some of the anticipatory loss groups and sessions as well.
Terrific. And how can people contact you if they want to reach out to you? Is there a way to do that?
Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, definitely feel free to look me up on LinkedIn and you can message me that way. But you're also more than welcome to even just email me at angie.aurora@senecacollege.ca, which is where I'm also kind of trying to advance some of the work in this area.
Terrific. Angie, it has been a pleasure to talk to you today. I really appreciate you taking time out.
I'm so grateful that you continue to create the spaces for us to be able to have these deeper dive conversations. It really means a lot because I think this is part and parcel of how we change the narrative.
Well, I love talking to everybody who's been on this show, and I'm continuing to learn. And I also make referrals for my clients who are still, you know, a lot of them are struggling through the anticipatory grief. And so we'll put all of these resources in the show notes, as well as your contact information. And is there anything else that you would like to say before we end?
Again, just a really sincere thank you for helping to shift the way we talk and think about these issues.
You're welcome. And thank you for your time too, and for the work that you do in the world, Angie.
Same goes to you.
Thanks. Have a good day.
You as well.
When we face the loss of a beloved pet, or when a pet is chronically ill or approaching old age, we often feel the sense of loss in many different ways. I remember when my dog was almost 16 years old, I kept staring at him while feeling the sense of loss, even when he was very much still alive and enjoying life. I realized I needed to not focus on the loss at that time, but appreciate the time I still had with him. I still have to remind myself to focus on the present moment instead of fears of what is to come in the future for all of my pets. But it is just part of our love for animals and the reality that they won't always be with us. It is also a normal reaction to have, as Angie pointed out during our discussion today. She mentioned a sixth stage of grief that has been called the meaning stage. I really like the idea of looking at what our pets have taught us and honoring them by recognizing how these gifts, these life lessons, have shaped our lives in many ways. I challenge you to think about how loved ones have touched and changed your lives, even when they are no longer around. I would also like to invite you to follow Animal Academy Podcast on any of the platforms where you listen to your podcasts. An announcement that I'm very excited to make is my new website is finally live. We worked really hard to create a site where you can go and find all of my podcast episodes, and they are actually categorized by topics, which also includes the show notes, resources, and blog posts. Please check it out and send me an email from the Contact Us form on the website. The website can also be found at ouranimalconnection.com. Thanks, everyone, for listening to this podcast. And thanks again for Angie for sharing her passions and work she does in the field to help those who are having challenges related to the relationship with their pets. Take care, everyone, and stay tuned for the next episode of the Animal Academy Podcast. Thanks for taking the time to listen to this episode of the Animal Academy Podcast. Detailed contact information and links for each of the guests and resources provided inside this episode can be found at my website, AnimalAcademyPodcast.com. I'm Allison White, licensed clinical social worker specializing in the human-animal connection. Let's share and learn from the animals in the next episode of the Animal Academy Podcast.